Hello and welcome to the Cloud Solution Architect podcast, where we talk to Azure architects from across the globe and discuss interesting and creative Azure solutions. This is your host, Anand Kumar. I work as a Cloud Solution Architect for Microsoft in the New York City region. For more Cloud Solution Architect podcast episodes, animated Azure videos, and simplified how-to content articles on Azure, please check out www.azuremonk.com. That's www.azuremonk.com. In this episode, we have with us Joe Sarabia, who works as a cloud solution architect in Microsoft. We talk about Joe's variety of experiences working on and with all the major private and public cloud providers out there, including VMware, Google, AWS, and now Microsoft. We also talk about the book, The Phoenix Project, how he bought low-cost, discounted machines at his local fry store to learn anti-migration, how he likes to quote-unquote build stuff to keep up with his continuous learning methodology, and much more valuable advice to anyone in the tech space. We also talk about two of his interesting projects that he has worked on, one focused around people and the other one around technology. Without further ado, let's get to the show. Welcome, Joe. Great to have you on the show.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
All right, great. I want to start off by asking, you know, how you got to where you are today. And I know you've had experiences and worked with all the major private and public cloud providers out there, Amazon, Google, VMware, and now Microsoft. So how did you make the transition to Azure? And more importantly, why and what were the driving forces that made you make the transition to Azure?
So that's it's a good question. Depends how much time I have, but I'll try to give you a short answer. I think that, you know, really my path started off as being a bit of an enthusiast in working with technologies at home, honestly. So I had a home lab even long before it's something I did professionally and tinkered around a lot. And I had my first exposure to technology actually working as part of a weather service. And I needed to be able to understand a lot of different systems, including how to process satellite imagery and, you know, doing that on different operating systems depending on where we were getting signals in from. So it could be Windows, it could be Unix, some Cisco stuff to interconnect it. And it turned out to be a lot of good training. So it's almost accidental, honestly, where I had this training and was trying to figure out new ways to use it, and, you know, happened to really get into technology, you know, full time, not just as something ancillary to what I was doing. I really honestly started off at kind of the bottom of the ladder, if you will, doing desktop support, even help desk for a little while. And that was my opportunity to apply some of these skills that I had in doing these weather services stuff in a new way. So I did that for a number of years and worked my way through different roles in IT operations, basically. And after a number of years doing that, I kind of got to a point of realizing that some of the projects that I was doing, I would only be able to do for my company once every few years, you know, tied to some sort of budgetary event or hardware refresh cycle or something like that. And that's about the time I got interested in doing something like the projects I have been doing for my organization, but doing that for other companies. And it really started with VMware. You mentioned VMware. VMware at the time solved problems for me that I couldn't solve in any other way, at least not at that price point. And I got super excited about VMware. It made a huge difference for our company. We went from having a business continuity disaster recovery plan that really was not feasible. You know, kind of I got promoted, it landed in my lap. No one had ever tested this plan. I tested the plan. And what we realized is if an event happened that we were concerned about, and I was living in LA at the time, so it was an earthquake, was the big thing. If that event happened, we would shut our doors as a business based on the technology we were using at the time and our recovery capabilities. So that's when we got into VMware, and it went from, you know, taking many days to be able to restore to many hours to be able to restore. So I wanted to be able to do that for more people and more customers, because it was really the first time that I felt that technology was a business driver. And what happened was at this particular place, when this happened and we reduced the recovery time so dramatically, the business said, well, if we can do it that quickly, we didn't realize it was possible. Maybe there's new things that we could do as a business that we didn't realize we could do before. And so it was the first time that I personally had experienced technology as a business enabler. So I wanted to do more of that. I ultimately went to go work for a partner doing a lot of VMware projects, and then went to VMware. VMware was good for some time. And then, you know, ultimately the technology was changing, the industry was changing. And cloud computing, when I was at VMware, I was fighting the other side of cloud computing, which was really, while virtualization had all this promise, and in some cases it did enable people to get infrastructure more quickly, in a lot of places, enterprises in particular, it still took many, you know, weeks, if not months, to get a new virtual machine, which was kind of counter to what people were trying to do. Mm-hmm. And the opposite force happening in enterprises was like, hey, if it's going to take me 6 to 8 weeks to get a VM, then I'm just going to swipe my credit card and get a VM from Amazon. And so I was kind of fighting that battle from the VMware front, and then, you know, ultimately decided that it was time to dip my toe into the public cloud arena. And what I realized, you know, up until the time even I joined Amazon, I had been focused really on the infrastructure side of things. But of course, that infrastructure was really all about the applications all along, because, you know, the apps have to run somewhere, and that's typically what you were providing the infrastructure for. And it was around the Amazon timeframe where I made more of a transition into application development. I had been long since working on a computer science degree. I took a break for a lot of years. I finished it up while I was at Amazon. And that's really where I got into DevOps. And then, you know, continued the journey on to Google and Microsoft. So that's kind of the background. You know, the why Microsoft for me honestly came down to the fact that Microsoft has a well-established pedigree of selling to enterprises for decades, more so than the other public cloud providers, I would argue, and in my experience, including, you know, Google and AWS. It's not that those other companies don't have that experience, but Microsoft has been doing it a long time and they understand enterprise pretty well. And so that's part of the reason why I was interested in coming to Azure. The other thing is it has to do with developer tools. You know, we have a lot of customers that are across the spectrum of capabilities. So in some cases, this can be they're doing fully containerized microservices on Kubernetes. On the other side, it might be they just want to push code to VMs, maybe living on IaaS, but in some cases, you know, these VMs might still be living on-prem. And so having a tool set that had a broad reach across that entire spectrum, also with, again, a long pedigree of building developer tools like Microsoft has, was a point of interest. And ultimately, you know, what led me to come here. I would say the last thing too was flexibility. We have generally a good amount of flexibility, you know, in our roles, and, you know, the ability to spend time both with customers and in Microsoft offices, and working from home for me personally was something that was hugely beneficial and contributed to my decision.
Awesome. You know, Joe, I'm actually reading the Phoenix Project, the book right now.
Yeah.
And most of what you're saying resonates to me, and the life cycle of how DevOps evolved. I can see the transition that you mentioned from virtualization world all the way up to cloud, right? And you also mentioned the flexibility that our role provides, and I have to absolutely agree with that, right? So from your perspective, how would you define a good and a bad day in your role as a cloud solution architect?
So it's a great question. So I think a good day is, and this happens pretty often in this role, and it's what I like about it, is for me personally, I like diversity in the problems I'm trying to solve or having new problems to solve. And so a good day to me is having all sorts of different things that maybe I've seen similar versions of, but not quite that version. So, you know, having something new and something new to tackle is pretty exciting. So I think that's a good day. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, other good days, and we may get into this a little bit later in the podcast, is when you really see the things that you're talking about resonate. You know, so the Phoenix Project is a great book, and they talk about it in there where, you know, Parts Unlimited is going through this huge transition. And then at some point, things start to click for the organization, and they understand how they can benefit from, you know, this cultural adaptation or doing things in these new ways. And so the really good days for me, especially because I'm focused today on doing DevOps type work, is mm-hmm. when you see things like what happens in the Phoenix project happen, you know, in real life in front of your eyes. So that's a good day. Mm-hmm. I think a bad day is, it's hard to define, you know, it's, you know, sometimes things don't happen as quickly as you want them to, I would say. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the upside is in cloud, we push, you know, I think upwards of, I forget the exact number, but I think it's plus or minus 1,000 releases a year. You know, it's usually at least a couple a day plus. Mm-hmm. Things are constantly changing. And so, you know, sometimes that can be a good thing, right? Because problems are getting solved. Honestly, sometimes that can be a bad thing too, because it's not uncommon for customers to know, you know, more about or something, even just something about a new feature that was released, you know, before it's been on my radar, because there's a lot to keep track of. Mm-hmm. But I think what makes you know, a bad day can just be, you know, sometimes you want to solve problems for customers more quickly than you can, and you have to deal at the end of the day, even though we release more quickly today, you know, sometimes you run into things with, you know, product management or other constraints where, you know, you just got to wait. And for me, a bad day is, you know, not being able to solve a customer's problem as quickly as I would like to. And that's, you know, that's just, I think, the reality of working in software. You know, sometimes we have to wait for things to happen, and I don't like seeing customers suffer. And that's when I have a bad day.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with you on that as well, because to your point, like, you know, we face most of the times when we face a customer and there's a certain problem that you can solve with this technology, but then you can do it better with version 2. Right. And there's only a few things that you can do. We have to wait for the product management team to release the version 2. Right. So that's, yeah, sometimes our hands get tied. Agreed. So you did mention that, you know, for you, a good day is working on a complex problem and trying to solve it, right? So from your perspective, what's the most interesting project that you've worked on, Joe, or an example of how you used cloud or Azure in particular to, you know, wow a business with your solution?
Yeah, there's probably a couple I can think of, and we may you know, edit one of these out. We'll see how it works. Mm-hmm. But there's probably a couple I can think of. There's one that's more, you know, process related, I would say, or culture related, and it ties back to the Phoenix project pretty well. Mm-hmm. And this is something that happens, you know, fairly recently actually, and it does involve a technology component to it. But it was more the cultural aspect that was interesting. So to give you some background, it was a customer that I don't know if I can name publicly, so I'll just refer to them as the customer. So this particular customer was interested in Azure DevOps. They have been using TFS in various, you know, incarnations of TFS for some time, and they have several development teams inside the organization. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things that you deal with in working with customers around DevOps and, you know, DevOps maturity is there's very often, you know, silos inside the organization. That's probably not news to anybody. And this particular customer was no exception to that, where you had these multiple development teams and they weren't always really talking to each other, you know, too much. Something that I'm really fond of talking about when I'm in customer meetings is the fact that, you know, you have these different areas that you have to consider in a DevOps transformation. And, you know, DevOps is one of these things you ask 10 people, you'll probably get at least 9 different answers about
what. Absolutely.
and you know, and maybe 10 or 11. And so, but I like to say there's this, you know, people, process, and product side to doing something with DevOps successfully. And I would argue that, this is what they get into in the Phoenix project, is that the product side is probably the easiest. It's not that it's easy, but I think it's the easiest because it's people and process that tend to delay or impede the ability to adopt DevOps full scale. And sometimes this can be silos in the organization. Sometimes it can be that you don't have, you know, the right support at the leadership levels. And so this particular example I'm giving is a case where, you know, they understood the product generally. There were different teams using TFS. They were all using separate instances of TFS. And really how I got involved with this particular customer is they were looking to migrate all of their TFS, which were a mix of mostly on-prem and then maybe one, you know, VSTS online version, all to the newer Azure DevOps services platform. which is great. And so part of what this necessitated was getting all of the different development teams in the same room so that we could understand, you know, what they were doing today. And, you know, a lot of what we do in architecture at Microsoft is similar to what you do elsewhere, where you have this, you know, current state analysis, you have some future state analysis and a gap analysis in between to figure out how to get there. And so a lot of that can be figuring out just, you know, what are they doing in these older versions of TFS? And is there anything that we lose fidelity wise, potentially in a migration or just, you know, aspects you have to pay attention to. So anyway, important to get them all in the same room, which we did. And it became relatively clear early on that there were pockets of excellence that existed on some teams that other teams were looking for. And so this materialized over the course of a few meetings. And you know, if you know Azure DevOps, it's really a suite of different products inside of there. And these teams were looking for, you know, various, you know, sessions on let's learn more about Azure pipelines, let's learn more about Azure boards. And then we got to this section or this workshop on Azure test plans. And by that point, I had realized that there was one particular team there who was pretty mature with Azure test plans, you know, much more so than honestly probably I am, to be frank, and certainly than anyone else in the organization was. And, you know, I'd been building a relationship with this development team over the course of time. And, you know, when it came time to do a demo, I asked someone from this particular team if they would be willing to just do a demonstration of how they were using Azure test plans for their particular projects and just demo it to the rest of the organization, which they were very, I'm very happy they were willing to do that. You know, they were receptive to that offer. They did this demo, and then something really interesting happened where, you know, they finished the demo. We talked about some plans and some capabilities, and then the other development teams were kind of like, oh my gosh, like we have this expertise in-house. Like we should set up our own meetings so that you can tell us more about what you're doing with Azure test plans, and then we can start doing the same things that you're doing. Mm-hmm. And so this was the kind of like, you know, live breaking down of the silos that we like to talk about when we're talking about people and process that happened inside of this meeting. And it was really exciting because, you know, the next couple of times I went there to follow up on how things were going, it turns out that this was actually happening, is that the teams were starting to talk to each other. And they were starting to, you know, you'd have someone on one team championing this capability of the platform in Azure DevOps to another team such that they would adopt it. And it's important for a lot of reasons. One is you know, there's this cultural aspect and breaking down the silos and just the communication barriers being flattened, like they talk about in the Phoenix project. But also, you know, the reality is a lot of customers you come into as a solution architect, you know, with all the answers. And some people look at that and say, you know, hey, that's great, but you don't have to deal with the day-to-day things that I have to deal with to try to do these things. Mm-hmm. So while it's great that you have these answers, you know, the real life implementation is something different. So to have someone inside the organization be a champion for this and dealing with the day-to-day, it's almost like, you know, in some cases, a customer will listen to someone else inside the customer than they will, you know, me as a solution architect. And so this was a really good day for me, right? Because now the customer is doing my work for me. Mm-hmm. And you know, the other like development groups inside this organization are listening to them. So that's one example of something that's more, you know, kind of like process related, but you know, related to DevOps, I think it's a good example of something that was exciting.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yep, I'm sure. I mean, like I can think of the aha moment, right? So the development team, when they see an in-house team, you know, sort of talk about a product and which can help them, like you said, instead of somebody external coming and speaking, their own in-house team speaking about it, it's definitely an aha moment. And then from there, I can see, you know, how the silos sort of break. Yeah, that's very interesting.
Yep, so that's a good one. I'll give you another one too, and then, you know, you can decide what you want to keep. But another example that was also recent is, you know, I mean, you talked about complex solutions. I'll be honest, right? There's a lot in our products today that make what used to be super complex, you know, 10, 15 years ago or whatever, like pretty easy to do today. And so there was another one of these examples where it was working with a different customer on application insights. Mm-hmm. And they were having some, you know, kind of sporadic application errors. They couldn't figure out exactly, you know, what was happening. And they had enabled, well, actually, we enabled by default some because they were running on app services. So they're running on platform as a service. We enable certain telemetry by default if you deploy a website on app services. So they deployed this application on app services. And then as we recommend, there's an SDK you can use by including a package and really like a couple lines of code that gives you a little additional, you know, telemetry that's helpful for things like, you know, more detailed stack traces. And so they had done this, which was great. And they were having these intermittent with zero discernible pattern application errors. And we were trying to figure out, you know, what was going on. Because they were using Application Insights, what we were able to figure out in about a less than 5 minute troubleshooting session was a root cause. And what that was basically we got down to a stack trace where we could see that some of these application errors were occurring when there was some sort of, you know, network timeout happening. And specifically, it was whenever the application was trying to do calls back to the SQL database. So when we went back to the logs on the particular SQL server, we discovered that the DBA team had been applying patches and rebooting the servers without talking to the application team. So this is a good example of silos that get in the way. Mm-hmm. But by using these tools that, you know, again, like a number of years ago would have been, you know, maybe more difficult to instrument, they were able to get to root causes, you know, pretty easily. And I see this kind of thing with Application Insights, you know, pretty often where once you have it set up, or even if you just deploy your website into PaaS and you get the stuff automatically, within a few clicks, you can figure out what's going on and get down to stack trace exception level, which just that type of work was, you know, hours long. If I think back to my IT operations days, if we were lucky, and mm-hmm. now it's something we can do, you know, in a few minutes, and the tools are intuitive to use. So, you know, I think there's good examples of where, you know, the complexity factor has been dramatically reduced by things such as platform as a service and some of the tools that you get in the cloud environment. You know, back to your early question around, you know, what was my journey like? You know, not having to build these sort of things yourself. You know, could I build the same thing? Maybe I could, but the time that I would take doing that in today's world with public cloud, that time is not as valuable as it is, you know, delivering value to my organization and really to the business by applying these tools. Mm-hmm. So I think that, you know, that's really, to me, the takeaway and just the journey of, you know, there's so much that we can do now. And, you know, the kind of complex solutions that we had to build, you know, 10 years ago now are just, they're built into cloud as services. And that's one of the things that makes them so powerful.
Absolutely. Yep. I mean, Application Insights, it's personally my favorite monitoring tool as well. I mean, for the benefit of listeners who are not aware, Application Insights is part of the Azure Monitor Suite. And like Joe mentioned, it not just works for the PaaS services, but also for, you know, infrastructure as a services, hybrid web applications, and even on-prem, right? You can also connect your Application Insights to an on-prem website. So it's really powerful. And I love the live, you know, troubleshooting feature. It gives yes. you live metrics. That's awesome.
Yep.
Awesome. Joe, so if you had to give advice to someone who's just starting off in the cloud solution space, right? So what would be your advice to them?
Wow. Yeah, that's a good question. So there's a few things, right? Like it's not an absolute necessity these days. I have a computer science degree. And I found that helped me out, mm-hmm. especially, you know, working app dev and DevOps, right? Being able to write code is useful, but there's also a lot of other skills that you gain when you study computer science. Now, I don't think these days you need a degree anymore. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of, you know, MOOCs and online options where you can learn about things like, you know, computer architecture and certainly programming languages. But I think, you know, honestly, again, a bias because this is the space that I work in, but I think having an understanding of applications and being able to write, you know, if not necessarily enterprise software, but lightweight applications and what those components are and how the apps use the infrastructure mm-hmm. can be, you know, tremendously useful. So I happen to have a background in both the infrastructure and app dev space, and that helps me out a lot because I can talk, you know, up and down the stack. So I would say that, you know, having familiarity with as much breadth as you can be useful. You know, even though you get a lot with these cloud services, understanding how things like compute, networking, and storage work before you start layering apps on top of it is pretty useful. The other thing that I would say is, you know, all of the cloud providers out there, Azure included, have some sort of free tier where you can tinker around for free. Or they also have, you know, when you're first signing up, you get some sort of credit typically where you can spend, you know, some amount of money on stuff that's a non-free tier. Even if you have to pay for it a little bit, you know, there were times where I remember doing, I'm going to date myself here, NT4O to Windows 2000 Active Directory migrations. And it's really before the VMware workstation days. And so I would go down to the local Fry's here in California, and I would wait till like the e-machines went on sale for 150, 200 bucks. And I would put three of them, you know, under my desk at home so that I could build out, you know, domain controllers and other things and practice migrations. And, you know, I was always spending money on lab equipment. It was probably more expensive doing that than it would be to, you know, fire up a few IaaS VMs today. But what I'm saying is, you know, you have so many options today, but it's worth getting your hands dirty, even if you have to pay for it, and run through various scenarios or just, you know, build out an application. If you're really new to the technology space, you know, something that can be really useful, honestly, which is advice I should follow myself because it's been on my to-do list somewhere for a number of years, but, you know, building your own website to run a blog, for example, and doing a custom domain name and host it on a public cloud. If you do those things, right, then you will learn, you're going to learn a lot about, you know, some of these elements. And then if you want to get fancy and it makes sense for, you know, what your objectives are, you could do things like, you know, use Docker containers for your website and start learning about that technology. But I would recommend applying, you know, the technology is a really useful thing to do. Another thing I'd recommend is if you're just starting out, there tends to be user groups out there all over the place. And so I would say, you know, check out, you know, whatever resources there are in your area. And this kind of, you know, varies from user group to user group. But, you know, check out and look for a local user group for the technologies that you're interested in and start attending. I've, you know, been part of different user groups. I've started user groups. I was a VMUG, that's the VMware user group. Leader. I actually started one when I lived in Santa Barbara, and I've been a part of other user groups as well. And you know, everyone that was going there was you know, there's a variety of experience there, and you tend to have, you know, people just starting out looking for answers. You have people that are more experienced that are more than happy to help you understand the technology. And so, user groups can be a really great safe place to have a discussion where, you know, you can ask a question, even if it's a, you know, quote unquote newbie question, and people are going to be receptive to that. So I think user groups are a great way to, you know, start, you know, getting into technology as well. The other thing I would add too is I'm just thinking back to some of the education programs that are out there. You know, if you're just starting out, say like you're in school, you're thinking about going to school, a lot of the major cloud providers have some sort of education program where you can get like an education discount, or they might even have courses that teach about, you know, cloud computing. I would say look into that. One thing that comes to mind, and again, I know it because of my area, but GitHub has a great education discount, and there's a lot of other software vendors out there that do too. So, you know, if you have like a .edu address and you're in education right now, say going through a degree and you're interested in getting into cloud solutions as a career, you can, you know, start getting your hands dirty with the tools at a highly discounted rate, you know, before you get out into the industry. And I think that, like, you know, once you get out in the industry, the ability to, you know, that you've had some knowledge with the tools will only help you. And, oh, this reminds me of the last thing, right? I mean, I'll just go back to the building thing, whether it's a website or something else. If there's always this kind of paradox of, you know, organizations want experience, but how do I get the experience without getting, you know, the first job? And so I think one of the ways that you do that is by, you know, building stuff, you know, build applications. I had a friend slash coworker who, you know, for fun built a, he built some sort of, it was some sort of game in C++, you know, not because he had to, but because he could. And this turned out to be something that he was able to discuss and other interviews and help them, you know, land a job at a big tech company. So, you know, actually building something and talking about that experience, you know, building something, and I think most importantly, what you learned from it will help you, you know, down the road. And I think it's just a great way to start out.
Awesome. I think that's very, very, very valuable advice, Joe. So, I mean, so you mentioned everything, right? Like all the fundamentals. You mentioned dog fooding, hosting your own website, getting your hands dirty, user group, educational courses, and the last point, build stuff. I think it's very critical. Building stuff, like you said, really, really gives a whole new perspective, and you can talk about what are the challenges that you went through when you were actually building it. So, you know, you mentioned everything from a fundamental perspective, right? But we all know how drastically things are changing around the cloud space, and especially for you, you know, sort of coming from three different cloud worlds, how do you keep up with all the changes that are happening in the cloud world? And do you map the different feature sets across different workloads? And do you have a routine, sort of a tool or a hack that you use? I know you mentioned a couple of things, but apart from that, do you have a certain routine just to keep up with all the changes that's happening in the cloud world?
Yeah, this is really hard, right? So in the days of, you know, commercial off-the-shelf software that did, you know, like one release a year or a couple of releases a year, it was easier, I think, to, you know, keep, you know, to kind of keep in sync with those changes, right? I mean, a lot of major releases would have, you know, too much to know, but it seemed easier as opposed to, you know, what I was mentioning earlier, where you have, you know, potentially multiple releases, you know, per day. And when you have multiple releases per day, it's kind of like, you know, that those accumulate, you have a busy week, right? And then you might be staring down a backlog of, you know, dozens of things that have happened to a product that you care about. So it can be hard for sure. So I think this is a fundamental challenge. And I think it changes, you know, really how business operates, because a lot of traditional activities around, even I just think about technical marketing, are different when you don't have, you know, one release a year to plan for or whatever. So how do you keep track of all these things changing? So I think that one of the ways is that all of these cloud providers today, I don't know that I have a specific hack, but I'll just talk through some of the things that I've done. All of these cloud providers today have some sort of, like, you know, RSS feed or blog or something where they release service updates, right? And mm-hmm. So you can read those. They're a little dry to be checking all of them. So what I find that has been useful over time is to use some sort of like feed or RSS aggregator. I happen to be a fan of Feedly just because it works well for me. And, you know, basically I subscribe, I create different kind of groupings for cloud providers of service updates. And then I just, you know, I scan these, you know, probably not every morning, but at least 3-4 days a week. And I try to make that part of the daily routine where I have a look at those. And I can see, you know, both what's been released kind of on a like a broad scale in Azure, but also I like to keep track of what's going on with the competition. You know, competitive threats are a constant thing to pay attention to. And so, you know, paying a little bit of attention to what the others are doing, I think can be useful just for context, because it will come up in conversations with customers, at least in the work that I'm doing. So I have, you know, kind of the broad strokes, right? And then I have more specific ones that are dedicated to just kind of like, you know, channels or feeds that are specifically for app dev and DevOps. So in there, I have stuff like Azure DevOps, right? So Azure DevOps at least has a 3-week release cycle, you know, plus or minus. So I'm definitely like on top, or try to be on top of every 3 weeks what the new release is and what came inside of that sprint. There's some community information that is in there. And then I also try to layer in some, you know, just like industry blogs or websites. There's a couple that I happen to like that talk about application development and architectural patterns, and just trying to, you know, stay abreast of those things as they come out. You know, things change, you know, it seems like they're accelerating, right? They're changing, you know, very, very quickly. And so some of it is just, you know, pattern recognition over time. Of seeing those things, okay, I'm hearing about this thing more. You know, Kubernetes was an example of that a few years ago, where, you know, it started popping up, you know, a lot more frequently, and it's like, hey, I need to learn more about this Kubernetes thing. The other thing too is customer meetings, and this varies depending on your job and what segment you're doing. I mean, if you're not in the industry, it's a little bit different, but I have a benefit of just kind of extrapolating patterns from customer conversations. So, you know, when they start asking about the same thing a lot, then sometimes that will fill in a gap that exists in these other places that I'm looking. So, you know, that certainly can be helpful as well. I think the last thing too, honestly, is in building things, like, you know, for me, and having expertise in Azure, you know, we talked about this earlier when we were talking about, hey, how do I get started? You know, look, my opinion of being a solution architect is that it's a journey of continuous learning. And so the same things that I recommend starting out are some of the same things that I'd recommend to stay current, because they are changing so fast. I mean, you know, we talked about some of my background. I feel like every couple of years I'm chucking out a large portion of my knowledge to replace it with something new. And the way that I do that is by, you know, building things. So I try to get in, because I have a lot of Azure DevOps conversations, I tend to be in there, you know, fiddling around with, you know, building pipelines or exploring the new features that came in this, you know, most current sprint, so that I can, you know, have a good understanding of them and explain them to users. So I think there's this element of just, you know, there's getting your hands dirty when you're starting out. And I think there's an element of keeping your hands dirty just by using the technology that I personally have found to be beneficial. The last thing I would say here is that, you know, if I were to draw a Venn diagram, you know, it's a podcast, but just, you know, if you imagine it in your mind that I have a Venn diagram with three circles on it, and each of those three circles represents the major three cloud providers, I think that there's very large portions of intersection. Right. Mm-hmm. And then each one of them probably has this periphery where there's something that they either do uniquely or that they do, you know, substantially better than one or two other cloud providers. But there's a lot of overlap. Right. And so once you learn one, I think that you can adapt to what the other ones are doing. And in fact, just, you know, because AWS was first to market with, you know, things like EC2, and S3 initially, that the frame of reference often tends to be, you know, AWS, and the other cloud providers will have, you know, kind of these secret decoder rings that allow you to translate, oh, if it's this in AWS, it means this in Google, or if it's this in AWS, it means this in Azure. The reality is, you know, they do things, you know, similarly in a lot of senses. So if you're trying to make a transition from, say, one cloud provider to another, and you know AWS, both Azure and GCP will have guides to help you accelerate understanding, you know, their technology. And there's also courses out there too that you can typically take as a one day, like, hey, I've done AWS for a few years, but now I'm moving to Azure. Then you can take a course, you know, to help understand and really just do the translation, because a lot of it will be conceptually familiar.
Yep, at least I know one course which says Azure for AWS administrators. Yeah, that essentially does a mapping of all the features, like you said. And I really like the Venn diagram concept that you talked about, right? In reality, that is true. So it's about most of the features do overlap between the three cloud providers. Yes, there's going to be a few, you know, sort of periphery features, but I like the way you talked about the Venn diagram. That's interesting. So Joe, I'm going to add your LinkedIn URL to the show notes for this episode. But apart from that, if people had to get in touch with you, what would be the best way to get in touch with you or the work that you do?
Oh, yeah. You know, I think LinkedIn might be the best. I am on Twitter, but, you know, frankly, I'm not very active. Mm-hmm. So I think LinkedIn is a good way. I mean, I'm happy to give out my email address. I don't, you know, have much of an SLA because I, you know, tend to be in a lot of meetings. But I'm happy to respond to email if that works better for you. Mm-hmm. You know, what I would say is, whatever your preferred mechanism is, if, you know, there's something that's come up in this, in my email, by the way, it's my first name dot last time at Microsoft.com, joe.sarabia@Microsoft.com. What I would say is, like, if there's something that I've talked about that's really resonated with you, you know, particularly if you're just starting out, you know, I'm more than happy, of course, time permitting, and it might take me a while to get back to you, but I'm more than happy to give, you know, more specific guidance depending on your, you know, situation. I think that I would just close it by saying that I think a lot of it was what we talked about, in the sense there was an element of grinding it out over a period of time and staying on top of the technology, where if you do that for long enough, it tends to pay off, you know, in the long run. Like at this point now, I've been working with vendors, you know, VMware, Google, AWS, now Microsoft, for about half my career. But my first half of the career was really, you know, just understanding all aspects of IT and IT operations and what it meant to be IT inside of a customer. And I worked in various verticals and having different, you know, expertise, because I worked in financial services, I worked in entertainment, I worked in like, you know, medical supply, medical devices, and having different areas of expertise. You know, what I found is that working in these different areas and for these different companies allowed me to take, you know, knowledge from kind of like one industry and apply it to another. And that's been really useful. But of course, it took time for that to materialize. So I think there is an element of like, you know, it takes some time for this to start, you know, to play out. But once it started to play out, and I was able to kind of see these abstractions or concepts that I could apply novelly in different places, then things, you know, really started to accelerate for me. I know that's a little, you know, conceptual and abstract as I get into it, but, you know, certainly anyway, back to the idea that I'm happy to help you out. It may take me some time to get back to you, but, you know, I'm more than happy to guide you on your path and, you know, stick with it, right? Like, don't get discouraged. I have broken more things than I can possibly keep track of. And that's part of how you learn, right? And that's why I recommend learning. I've had some oops, you know, potentially career limiting moves at work that, you know, frankly, I was fortunate to have understanding bosses at the time. But, you know, part of getting your hands dirty was learning what not to do, right? And so it's such good, it's part of what makes it useful talking to customers. I've taken so many arrows in my back, as I can tell them, you know, certain things that they should avoid doing. And that really, you know, helps them out. But still, right, I mean, it's not going to be perfect 100% of the time. I learn new stuff every single day. In fact, that demo I was talking about earlier, when the customer was demonstrating Azure Test Plans, I learned something new myself from the customer. So it's, again, this idea of continuous learning. Don't be afraid to break stuff. You know, don't get discouraged. Keep at it. And if there's some way that I can help out, you know, please do reach out, and I'm happy to help however I can.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I loved how your positive outlook in life is and the continuous learning, and also how you said, you know, failing is not really an end state. It's definitely, we learn more about what not to do than what we can do. Yes. With that note, thank you so much, Joe, for joining this call. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to be a part of it. And thanks again for having me. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you.